Next case is United States v. Simpson. This is a certified case, so the government is the appellant and will go first. Is the government prepared to argue? Is the appellee prepared to argue? Government may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Mark Sawyer, and along with Major Michael Cordy, will be arguing for the United States. This court should find that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in accepting appellee's guilty plea, and there is no substantial basis in law or fact to question that plea. First, the lower court had no basis to overturn the conspiracy conviction. Second, in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Shaw v. United States, both J.P. Morgan Chase and CFNA could have had a possessory interest in the account. Finally, this case is analogous to this court's decision in United States v. Symbol Sharpton, and an unusual charging decision was appropriate.
So you say in your brief that CFNA was the right person because they suffered losses from the theft, making them a victim under Symbol Sharpton. We cleared that up. That's not the test. That's not the rule. And I don't know how many different ways and different times we have to tell you. And yet you come here with a certified issue with the same question. Why don't you just have them charge these things correctly? It's not that hard.
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at Symbol Sharpton and the way
this... I have looked at it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Many times.
I understand, Your
Honor. And again, and again, and again.
The reason this case is similar to Symbol Sharpton, Your Honor, is both the unusual nature of the account, the way the payments came from CFNA to J.P. Morgan, and what eventually happened in this case in terms of how J.P. Morgan reversed the transactions. Now, in this case, this was a zero-balance checking account, not a traditional savings account, not a traditional checking account, and not a traditional debit account that we would normally see in an electronic larceny transaction. The account would pay CFNA's creditors as they do ACH debits, and every day CFNA wired money into that account in order to bring the account back up to a zero balance, Your Honor. This account handled 17,000 transactions and $15 million each month. And after appellee's fraud was discovered, CFNA put a lock on the account to stop further transactions. And under federal banking law, J.P. Morgan Chase reversed the prior 60 days of the transactions and eventually reversed transactions going back to January of 2010, approximately 10 months. However, none of the transactions that occurred prior to January 2010 were ever reversed, and the loss came simply from CFNA. When the music stopped, CFNA, Your Honor, did not have a chair. Now, what makes this unusual is both the way CFNA paid J.P. Morgan Chase and what occurred after the fraud was discovered. Because CFNA paid J.P. Morgan Chase every day, the money came from CFNA every day, whether or not the transactions were fraudulent and whether or not they were valid.
But who did the appellant get the money from?
J.P. Morgan Chase, Your Honor.
Right, so why are you talking about CFNA and what they did with Chase?
Your Honor, that would be no different than U.S. Bank providing the money to the various merchants as a card is swiped, and then the Air Force paying U.S. Bank each day whether or not the transaction is fraudulent. In this case, CFNA paid, or Air Force probably paid every month. In this case, CFNA paid every day whether the transactions were fraudulent. Also separating this case from Williams, Your Honor, is in Williams, the charged victims only suffered a collateral loss. In that case, the appellant swiped the victim's debit cards. He did a series of purchases. The accounts were overdrawn, and in the end, the victims in Williams only suffered the collateral loss of the account fees and the bank fees and the overdraft fees that occurred when that happened. The bank in Williams actually suffered the loss and reimbursed the victims in that case. Here, there's one entity that, when the music stopped, never lost a chair, and that's J.P. Morgan Chase. J.P. Morgan Chase facilitated these transactions. J.P. Morgan Chase may have sent the money to the various entities that requested it, but when the music stopped, J.P. Morgan Chase did not suffer any loss.
But that's not the The test isn't who suffered the loss.
Yes, Your Honor. The test is who has the possessory interest. And what this indicates is that the CFNA had a possessory interest in the money that was being distributed. CFNA is the one that sent the money every day. CFNA is the one that paid for all the goods that were being purchased, or the credit balances that were being filled. And that's how this case is analogous to Symbol Sharpton. We realize, the government acknowledges, that there is no contract in this case. There's no explicit contract in this case, as there was in Symbol Sharpton, that made the Air Force absolutely liable for that. However, the nature of the account and the way that it operated indicates that there was some sort of contract, either the nature of the account or a contract between CFNA and J.P. Morgan Chase. That
is that evidence in the record?
It's not, Your Honor.
Is it a stipulation of fact?
It is not, Your Honor.
Can we consider it?
It can be inferred, Your Honor. And based on that inference in a guilty plea where the facts aren't going to be completely developed, we believe this case is analogous to Symbol Sharpton for all the reasons stated above, Your Honor.
Counsel, yes, with respect to the record, what is the record that we look at here in terms in a guilty plea case? What is the scope of information that's available to us in analyzing these transactions?
The scope of the information, Your Honor, would simply be the stipulation of fact, the Providence inquiry, and any exhibits that are in the joint appendix.
Thank you.
So, counsel, if this court were to disagree with your analysis about who had possessory interest and the issue that you refer to as who doesn't have a chair when the music stops, could the government's case still be saved based on examining this case through the construct of a guilty plea and what is required for a guilty plea?
Yes, Your Honor. The government's case can still be saved both because of the dicta that I'll discuss from Shaw versus United States, and also that the conspiracy conviction can be saved as the lower court had no basis to overturn that conviction. Turning to Shaw versus United States, the Army Court erred in its application of Williams because Shaw superseded Williams and undermines the legal underpinnings in that case. Citing Williams, the Army Court held, quote, as a matter of law, CFNA had no possessory interest in the funds maintained in their account in J.P. Morgan Chase, end quote. The Army Court treated the possessory interest of the funds as a matter of law as opposed to a matter of fact. Now, Shaw interpreted the Bank Fraud Statute, 18 U.S.C. 1344.1, and as the Army Court discussed, it was actually the flip side of this case. Does the bank have a possessory interest in the customer's account? And the government acknowledges that...
the answer is always yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's the problem, right?
Yes, Your
Honor.
It's
their money.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what does that sort of truism have to do with anything else? What does it have to do with CFNA?
Your Honor, the dicta in that case and the way the case was written indicates both that the customer and the bank may have a possessory interest in the account, and that the question of who has a possessory interest in the account is a question of fact as opposed to a question of law. In Shaw, the court stated that, quote, the bank, too, had property rights in the customer's account, implying that both the bank and the customer have property rights in the account. Moreover, the court discussed situations where a bank may not be the owner of the account and the customer can retain ownership, for example, under contract law, but noted in even in those cases, the bank acting as a bailee can guard the funds against anyone except the customer. In other words, the bank retains a possessory interest in the account. Finally, in that case, the court noted that the customer, too, always retains the rights to withdraw funds, indicating that it's potentially that the customer retains rights to the possessory interest in the account, even if the bank has a possessory interest or owns the funds. What we're arguing, Your Honor, is in light of Shaw, the Army Court was incorrect for two reasons. First, both CFNA and J.P. Morgan Chase could have had a possessory interest in the account under the dicta we see in Shaw. Second, Shaw indicates that the question of who has a possessory interest in the account is a question of fact and not a question of law. And the Army Court explicitly stated that they were overturning this conviction because the issue of the possessory interest in the account is a question of law, not a question of fact, and therefore the government charged it incorrectly. In this case, the stipulation of fact and the Providence inquiry before this court and before the Army Court both factually establish that CFNA had a possessory interest in the account. And if it's a question of fact, and this is a guilty plea with an undeveloped record, there is no substantial basis in law or fact to overturn that guilty plea.
Is your position, counsel, that based on Shaw now, if because of the dicta in Shaw, that the proper victim of a larceny for money taken from USAA would be the account holder? I mean, because it seems to me that that would overrule some decades of precedent by the Supreme Court and other courts.
Your Honor, it would depend on the specific facts on this case. The government argues...
you're relying on it being the flip side, right? And the dicta being what the dicta is. That by saying two, that means that both.
We are relying on that, Honor, but we're also acknowledging that it depends on the specific facts on the case.
Well,
and the specific
Shaw was
facts.
A person and a bank.
Yes, Your Honor. It was
why don't we limit it to those specific facts?
In that case, Your Honor, the court was, in its broad discussion of the ownership of the bank, indicated that both the customer and the bank may have a possessory interest, and indicated that it would be a question of fact before the court. In this case, the facts were established in the stipulation of in the providence that CFNA had a possessory interest in the account. And the government argues that under that scenario and under the facts before this court and before the Army Court, that there's no substantial basis to overturn the conviction based on those facts and based on the dicta from Shaw, Your Honor.
Counsel, on page 4 of the brief, it's noted that Pelley paid $30,000-plus of utility bills and accounts and debts from this amount. At the end of the day, after certain charges were reversed, how much money did CFNA lose in this process?
Your Honor, from what we have in front of us, I believe it's $50,000, $30,000, and from the appellee, and $20,000 to the scheme with Sergeant Ramos. There were other victims and other individuals involved in this case, but I'm not aware of anywhere in the record of.
Does that mean that when charges reversed, CFNA lost everything at that point, or were some of the? Did CFNA recover any of it? Did they lose the full $30,000 from appellant?
Your Honor, all of the transactions going back to January of 2010 were eventually reversed. CFNA permanently lost the money going from August to December of 2009.
Right. That's what I'm asking. How much was the permanent deprivation of CFNA?
I do not have an answer for you right now. I apologize.
Was it above the minimum amount for the maximum punishment in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. And I'd also note in Shaw, the Supreme Court discusses the temporary loss of funds and how that could still be a victim.
I understand that. I'm just focusing on what the permanent loss of funds is now.
Yes, Your Honor. The permanent loss of funds was over the minimum for the offense, for the $500 minimum. Turning now to the conspiracy, the Army Court had no basis to overturn the conspiracy conviction in this case, and it did so without any discussion. As established in Pelley's stipulation and his Providence inquiry, he entered into an agreement with Sergeant Ramos to steal funds from CFNA. Conspiracy requires an agreement to commit an illegal act and an overt act in furtherance of that conspiracy. Appellee told Sergeant Ramos that his girlfriend possessed an account number that could be used to steal funds from CFNA. Sergeant Ramos would have to provide Ms. Lee with money, compensation for this, approximately half the value of what was being paid off from his debts each month in the form of AFI's gift cards. Sergeant Ramos then took the overt act of contacting Ms. Lee and getting the account information to set up the thefts. Once he took that overt act, the crime was complete. And whether or not this court finds that CFNA was the proper victim under Article 121 UCMJ, in terms of a conspiracy, the conspiracy was complete, and this court should find the Army Court erred there. And this is analogous to the case we cited in our brief, United States v. Thomas, where there's an issue of factual impossibility, where the appellants conspired to rape a young woman who collapsed in a bar. However, she was already dead, and therefore the rape could not actually occur. However, the conspiracy to commit rape certainly could. Even in this case, if this court determines that CFNA is not the correct victim, and as a matter of law, the government charged this incorrectly, certainly the conspiracy to steal from CFNA was still complete when the appellee and Sergeant Ramos entered this agreement, and Sergeant Ramos took that overt step to steal those funds from CFNA, and whether or not J.P. Morgan Chase was the actual victim would be immaterial.
Counsel, does that save all of the offenses from the larceny, or only the offenses that involve Ramos?
Only the offense that involves Ramos, Your Honor.
So the government did not charge the appellee in this case with a conspiracy to enter into a conspiracy with his girlfriend.
They did not, Your Honor. The judge discussed it on the record. I think it's in around JA 61.
Yeah. This is additional charge too?
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize for not being more specific. So in conclusion,
before this, question, since the charge of conspiracy did not cover all of appellee's transactions, what would be the remedy in this case if we were to conclude, and I'm not asking you to concede, but if the court were to conclude that the larceny charge should be thrown out and the conspiracy charge should be sustained, here you would then have a conspiracy that doesn't cover all of the charges in the larceny. Could we affirm the sentence as well here, or would we, in those circumstances, need to send the case back to the CCA for sentence reassessment?
The case should be sent back to the CCA for sentence reassessment. Enough of the factors would change that the sentence would need to be reassessed by the CCA.
And why not a sentence rehearing at that point?
You look at the...
is this the sentence? Reduction to E4, confined for 2 months in a BCD?
Yes, Your Honor. Rehearing would not be necessary, Your Honor. The CCA could reassess based on their powers. If you look at the sentence, it's very light in comparison to what the maximum sentence would be. While the amount stolen would certainly change from approximately $50,000 to approximately $30,000, it's still well over the minimum. And he was sentenced by a judge alone. The CCA would be able to look at that and reassess the sentence. In conclusion, Your Honor, the appellant requests this court determine that the military judge did not abuse his discretion accepting appellee's guilty plea, and there's no substantial basis in law or fact to question that plea.
Thank you.
Any more questions?
Counsel for the appellee.
Chief Judge Stuckey, Senior Judge Efron, judges of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Joshua Fix, together with Captain Steve Dre. We represent Sergeant Randy Simpson. This court should affirm the decision of the Army Court because the opinion in Shaw does nothing to change the outcome in this case, and the Army Court applied this court's precedent in Williams to reach the correct decision.
Okay, upfront question. Why isn't this thing waived? He pled guilty. This is a guilty plea. He waived a trial on the, you know, if this is a question of fact. He could have said, okay, I want to litigate this question of fact. He didn't. He said, guilty plea, Your Honor, bye-bye. Why isn't this whole thing waived?
Your Honor, under CARE and the CARE doctrine, the providence of a plea is based not only on the accused's understanding and recitation of factual history, but also his understanding of how the facts relate to the law. And here it is clear that the appellee did not understand how the facts related to the law, because he seemed to believe he committed an Article 121 larceny from a party he could not have committed an Article 121 larceny from. Therefore, he was not provident to his plea.
OK.
You agree that it would have been waived, you know, I'm not asking you to concede, but if he had been properly apprised, it would have been waived?
If the Providence inquiry had demonstrated that he understood the law, Your Honor, and did not raise substantial facts in conflict as it wound up doing, then yes. But that's not the situation that we have here, of course.
Counsel, one of the aspects of care, as distinguished from Providence or inquiries that are made in as a minimum requirement in federal civilian courts, is the statement of fact that the accused can't simply say amen or yes, but he has to state from his or her own mouth what happened. So on J46, the accused said, she, the girlfriend, was taking my account information onto a computer and then taking the funds from Credit First National and putting in their account information to misrepresent that I was a lawful owner of the account that I was using to pay my bills. To follow up on Chief Judge Stuckey's question, why isn't that a factual basis to sustain the conviction in this case?
Well, because based off of the nature of the account, Your Honor, as a matter of law, the CFNA did not have a possessory interest in those funds. And it was clear that the appellee did not understand that.
Well, where in the record do you find the facts that demonstrate that the statement made by the appellee in this case was so incorrect that it's an improvident plea?
It's the stipulation of fact, Your Honor. The stipulation of fact lays out in great detail how this account worked, and that stipulation is in conflict with the notion that CFNA actually had a possessory interest in these funds.
So what the case comes down to then is an improvident plea because, in your view, an improvident plea because the accused misstated what happened in the case?
Well, he didn't he both misstated what happened in the case, and he was attempting to plead guilty to a charge that was factually impossible. He was attempting to plead guilty to an Article 121 larceny where CFNA was charged as the party from whom funds were obtained, when in fact the stipulation of fact clearly lays out that CFNA was not a party from whom funds were obtained.
But why, and I don't know what the answer to this is, but why or why not does the fact that it was a zero balance account matter?
So the zero balance account matters.
Because the government's arguing that this falls into the exception that we recognize from Lebaskian about the alternative charging theory, right, which is that ordinarily you charge it one way, but sometimes you can charge it another way. Why isn't this such a case?
So this is not such a case, Your Honor, because an unusual account is not free license for the government to charge any party it chooses as the party from whom funds are obtained. There still needs to be analysis of the party from whom funds are actually obtained. And so the zero balance account here functions as a credit account. It never has a positive balance. It is charged against, and then at the end of the billing cycle, in this case apparently a day, CFNA reimburses J.P. Morgan for funds that were charged out of that account. So the account actually, for most of the time, actually is in a debt state. It never is in a positive state. It is not a depository account, Your Honor. And there are really two reasons why Shaw is easily distinguishable here. The first is that it is a different kind of bank account. Shaw is about a depository account, and this is about a zero balance
account. I don't think Shaw has anything to do with anything. I mean, I think that it's dictum. It's talking about whether or not federal bank fraud occurred, right?
We are in agreement then, Your Honor.
So, I'd like to hear the other half of this, though.
And the other half, Your Honor, is that Shaw is about a different statute.
Right.
Perhaps a statute that the government could have and maybe even should have charged in cases like this. It's about the federal bank fraud statute. And that is a much cleaner statute when dealing specifically with larcenies from, or not even larcenies, but frauds against financial institutions. If this were charged under the federal bank fraud statute, then we frankly would not be here today.
Is that is it the defense position then that use of the federal bank fraud statute is not preempted by the larceny article of the UCMJ?
No, Your Honor, it does not appear to be preempted, neither bank fraud nor wire fraud. I'm actually personally more familiar with wire fraud, so I'll give my explanation for that first and then for bank fraud by analogy. So wire fraud and mail fraud, it's close sibling in the U.S. Code. They're specifically concerned with frauds using channels of interstate commerce, and so the gravamen of the offense is not a taking, but a use of those channels of interstate commerce in order to effect a fraud.
So if we agree with you and say, yes, the plea is busted, you know, we agree with the CCA, we agree with you, is there anything that would preclude the government from charging your client with federal bank fraud for the same offenses? I mean, I don't see what would preclude them from doing that.
Your Honor, I, of course, do not intend to bind my client to a particular answer to that question later down the road here. Perhaps there would be some sort of a double jeopardy analysis. I am simply offering this as an explanation for how these how such cases could be charged much more cleanly. However, they don't need to be charged, necessarily speaking, under the bank fraud or wire fraud statute. This court provided clear guidance in Williams how to charge cases like this. And the simple answer is not the way it was charged in this case. The government,
if it's not preempted, is there any cap on the mat? And I know you're not conceding that it's not preempted, but you're not offering any argument that it would be. Assuming that it's not preempted, would there be any cap on the maximum punishment that could be imposed upon a new trial using the bank or wire fraud statute as incorporated under Article 134?
Your Honor, that's I am frankly not prepared to answer that question here today because I would need to do further analysis that I'm simply not going to be able to conduct on the fly.
Or a U.S. attorney in federal district court.
That is a possible course of action for the sovereign, Your Honor.
But here's what we have to decide here. Assuming that this is a guilty plea issue and goes to the providency, the normal determination would be not to dismiss the charges in terms of a preclusive effect here, but to set aside the findings, and the government would have an opportunity to either try it in a contested manner new charges. So we have to decide what our remedy would be if we agreed with you that the plea was improvident in this case. But it's not just an issue down the road for the court to consider based on what may happen in a future proceeding. True, the parties would have the opportunity to raise motions at that point. But in terms of the effect of what we do now, that goes to the nature of the remedy in the case.
Yes, Your Honor. And so there are multiple avenues open to the government in to charge offenses like this. So all the appellee is suggesting here is that the government had other ways of charging this. They had clean ways of charging this, and they did not. It also could possibly still be charged under 121 with a appropriate party from whom the property was obtained. Although there is, frankly, a separate question as to whether or not the transfer of funds from J.P. Morgan to various creditors constitutes an obtaining of property by the appellee when the appellee was never in possession of that property. But that is not a question. That's a question for another day, Your Honor.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? It's going back to something that's been addressed before, but I just want to make sure I understand it. So you're saying that the accused pled guilty to an offense where there was no factual basis for that offense, correct?
And there was no legal basis as charged, Your Honor.
And you're saying that that was evident on the face of the stipulation of fact. But it wasn't evident to defense counsel. It wasn't evident to military judge. Presumably, it wasn't evident to government counsel. So why should that be evident to this court? The record was not further developed because the accused chose to plead guilty. So you're explaining to us how this zero balance account worked, but we don't have any basis to understand any contractual relationship between CFNA and J.P. Morgan Chase or anything like that. So how is it that we know so much more by looking at the four corners of the stipulation of fact than the military judge and the others as parties of the court-martial?
Your Honor, I can only speculate as to why the parties in the court-martial did not catch this.
I don't think that's what he's asking. I think what he's asking is the stipulation of fact says what it says. You're relying now on the fact that there's no contractual relationship, so this isn't Symbol Sharpton, so it's not the unusual thing, but it doesn't say that in the stipulation of fact. It doesn't say that in the provenance inquiry, and therefore, why is there a substantial basis, in fact, based on what's in the record?
So based off of what's in the record, Your Honor?
Because I understand we can't bring our outside knowledge of financial institutions and financial transactions into play here, right? We're stuck with what's in the record.
So unlike in Symbol Sharpton, Your Honor, it is actually in the stipulation of fact that here CFNA was able to recover the vast majority of the funds.
It doesn't matter if they recovered it or not.
Well, part of the basis, for Symbol Sharpton, Your Honor, is that the unusual contractual relationship precluded the recovery of those funds. And so the other problem with trying to apply Symbol Sharpton to this case is that Symbol Sharpton, much like the what I believe was the UPB account in Lubasky, was a case about exceeding the authorized use of an account as opposed to fraudulently using an account that the accused at trial has no lawful relationship with. And so that portion of the joint appendix that discusses, and I believe this also gets to Judge Efron's question about the total loss, it's on joint appendix pages 93 through 95. It discusses the fact that how the account worked, the fact that CFNA was able to recover all of the funds prior to all of the transfers after, I believe, it was January 1st of 2010. And so, Your Honor, I don't have the math for you, but the answer is in the large table on Joint Appendix 94 through 95. If one simply draws a line between the first 2010 transaction and the last 2009 transaction and adds up the sum of the figures above the line, you will get the answer to that question.
It would appear to be well above $500.
Yes, Your Honor. Somewhere upwards of $4,000 by my brief calculation without the aid of a calculator.
That's why we're lawyers and not scientists.
So it says in paragraph 11 of your stipulation of fact, the unauthorized use of the CFNA information resulted in a total of $30,000 being transferred from the CFNA account to accounts owned or controlled by the accused. why doesn't that statement there show that it was, whether it's true or not, right, but based on the stipulation of fact, why doesn't that represent that CFNA was the person from whom funds were obtained? And I understand your other point, which is that's not true, right?
Well, because, Your Honor, it is contradicted by the explanation of how that account worked on page 2 of the stipulation of fact, which is at Joint Appendix page 93. On that page, which is evidence before the trial court, it is explained how that account worked and the fact that this is a zero balance account. And what is explained is an account functioning as a credit account.
So why shouldn't the court be concerned about defense counsel in future cases putting in these little landmines? We're going to enter into a stipulation of fact where we know it's complicated when it comes to financial agreements or other types of cases, and we're going to put in this little package for our client where it's going to blow up on appeal.
Well, and ordinarily, I don't, you know, that probably is not a judicious strategy for most defense counsel in most cases, Your Honor. Also,
well, there's no doubt here in this case that the accused stole money. The only question is from whom. So it's not a situation where I think you're going down the path of saying, why would you plead to something where you're innocent? This client was not innocent. So that's why I'm getting to the point of concern that defense counsel might put in a little present for the accused that blows up in the government's face on appeal.
Well, and even in the cases with the clear guilt of some offense, Your Honor, it probably is not ordinarily in an accused's best interest to do that. But there's another component to it, too, and that is the government, this court in Williams and the MCM give clear guidance for how to charge such offenses. And the government also has the option of charging such offenses under federal bank fraud or wire fraud statutes. And so it is the government's responsibility to ensure that it is a proper charge as it is written on that charge sheet. And for whatever reason, that didn't happen here. It is possible that there is some continued confusion among the military military justice bar regarding the proper individual to charge based off of Symbol Sharpton. Now, I'm not sure why that would be, given that this court clarified that in Williams. But to the extent that there is continued confusion, this court can use this case to further clarify that, and if necessary, explicitly explain that Symbol Sharpton's rationale may have been overruled, although its result was correct for the reasons stated in Williams. I see that my time has expired, Your Honor.
Chief Judge, I have one question. I hate to prolong the argument, but nothing against you. You have a fine argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But I assume that at the lower court, your prayer for relief was to have the police set aside and a rehearing. And the CCA agreed with you, did they not?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so my question then is, what favorable or more favorable outcome are you seeking? It goes back, and if you're not willing to talk about that, I understand. But I'm just curious. The accused got a bad kind of discharge and in 2 months confinement. You go back and you have a rehearing. I suppose you could decide you're going to plead not guilty at that point.
And
I'm not asking you to reveal any future strategy, so to speak.
And I'm not in a position to, Your Honor, because in full candor, I was not representing Sergeant Simpson at the time of the CCA appeal.
I see.
And so I would blame only
on those
be
guys.
Speculating.
Blame it on those guys down at the CCA.
I would only be speculating as to whatever conversations were had.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal. Thank you. Case is then submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Court is in recess until further order of the court.
Court is adjourned until further order of the court.